Iran slams the new U.S. administration for pressing ahead with a policy of maximum pressure against the Islamic Republic. The Syrian army says it has intercepted most of Israeli missiles fired from the occupied part of the Golan Heights over Damascus. And political tensions are rising in Myanmar while the Southeast Asian country witnesses fresh protests against the recent military coup, despite intensified fracking. Hey everyone, welcome to World News here in the Iranian capital. I'm your host, Behzad Sajjadi. Good to have you with us. Now, Tehran saying that Washington is still following the wrong policy of maximum pressure by former President Donald Trump as regards the 2015 nuclear accord. Foreign Ministry spokesman Said Khatibzadeh says that Washington needs to move away from such policies and act in the right way. It says if the other signatories to the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action continue to violate it, Iran will further scale back its commitments. Khatibzadeh said, however, that all those actions are reversible on condition that the other parties to the deal comply with their commitments. He also emphasized that Iran's stance on the peacefulness of its nuclear activities remains unchanged, as the leader of the Islamic Revolution has banned the production and use of any forms of mass destruction weapons. From Bangkok, I'm now joined by Brian Berletic, an independent geopolitical analyst. Good to have you with us, Brian. So how do you look at this? Will the Biden administration stick to their presidential electoral slogans and, talking of reversing what Trump had done regarding the Iran nuclear deal and some other stories, or will they pursue, as the Iranian foreign minister is complaining, the erroneous and maximum pressure campaign of the former administration?
I think the Biden administration has already made that quite clear. They've said that they're going to continue pressure on Iran, and they expect Iran to come into full compliance with a deal the U.S. itself walked away from unilaterally and without justification. And we saw Iran continue upholding that deal even after the U.S. left it. And they only started to scale back their commitments once it became clear that the U.S. pressure on Europe meant that the sanctions wouldn't be lifted. So why would Iran remain a party to a deal that it's gaining no benefit from, and all the parties that signed it with Iran have not honored that deal?
Now, Brian, the question is, One wonders what made Iran actually to start scaling back and reducing its commitments within the deal. It was the U.S. withdrawal from it, the reimposition of sanctions on Tehran, and the European signatories just sitting there and doing nothing.
That's exactly right. That's exactly what happened. And Iran has signaled its willingness to return to the deal. What the United States now expects Iran to do is return to the negotiation table with parties who have acted in bad faith. They had violated the deal. They proposed this deal to Iran, and then it seemed as if they were trying to deliberately sabotage it so that they could blame Iran for not holding up to its commitments. We remember under the Trump administration, the U.S. accusing Iran of violating it with no evidence at all. And now we see, even though Biden, during his campaign, said that he was going to reverse this policy, we see that the policy is still very much in effect. And I would just like to point out one other thing about this. U.S. policy papers since 2009 had openly conspired, basically, to offer this deal to Iran specifically for this purpose, to make it look like the U.S. was trying to be reasonable. They fully planned not to honor it, to walk away from it, and then blame Iran for it. And we could see that unfolding right now, even with the change in the White House.
Okay, thank you very much for your contribution and insight. Brian Berletic, independent geopolitical analyst, who joined me out of Bangkok. Syrian air defense systems have intercepted several Israeli missiles over the capital, Damascus. Mohammed Ali earlier joined us and provided us some detail on that attack.
And just a few minutes ago, the Syrian Army Command issued a statement giving some more details, saying at about 1:18 a.m. Local time here in the Syrian capital, the Israeli side carried out an aggression, firing a number of missiles from the occupied Syrian Golan and targeting some Syrian army positions. Most probably around the capital, Damascus. Syrian air defenses, according to the Syrian army, were directly activated and shot down most of the enemy missiles. Now, this is not the first time that this happens, for sure. Hundreds of attacks, perhaps, since the start of the crisis in Syria. Israel has been attacking the Syrian army with the aim to undermine the capabilities of the Syrian army, which is fighting terrorists on the ground.
A number of government organizations in Yemen have warned that basic services will no longer be available if oil vessels detained by the Saudi-led coalition aren't immediately released. Our correspondent in Sana'a has more.
The ministries of health, water, electricity and communication, along with the Yemeni Petroleum Company, have held a press conference in Sana'a to call on the international community to intervene and stop the collapse of these vital sectors due to the lack of fuel.
The siege has increased and the crisis has exacerbated a lot. We no longer have oil derivatives and there has been no reaction from the international community but useless media statements. We need serious work and real pressure on the Saudi-led coalition and the U.S. to allow entry of oil ships because their detention is illegal. These ships have been searched and given permits from the United Nations, who bears responsibility with what Yemenis are facing.
Officials said the country is on the verge of catastrophe as only 11 out of 2,000 gas stations are working. However, 5,000 health facilities, including 15 dialysis centers, may stop providing health services due to lack of fuel, which will cause more loss of lives.
Some medicines need continuous refrigeration, oxygen factories, intensive care units, emergency rooms, and also baby incubators will stop in thousands of health facilities. This will lead to humanitarian catastrophe and the loss of more lives. Oil derivatives are the basis of the work of all sectors, and we call on the international community to stand with the Yemeni people.
Yemenis are suffering a severe fuel crisis as 12 oil ships are still illegally detained by the Saudi-led coalition for months now, amid the continuous silence of the United Nations and the international community. Millions of Yemenis spend days in long lines to get some liters of petrol, which will be cut off within days unless the international community step in and pressure the Saudi-led coalition to release the detained oil vessels. Abdul Latif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
The operator of Dubai International Airport says that the airport saw a 70% drop in passenger numbers last year as a result of the COVID-19 pandemic. West Asia's busiest airport handled some 184,000 flights in 2020. That was down over 50% compared to the pre-pandemic era. The average number of passengers per flight also fell over 20%. Experts saying it'll take years for the industry to recover since there are still travel restrictions in place in many countries. Now, in Myanmar, anti-coup protesters defy an intensified crackdown by the military and take to the streets in several cities across the country. Hundreds of university students have rallied in Myanmar's largest city of Yangon. There has been a similar demonstration in the southern city of Dawei. The fresh protests come as the military deployed extra vehicles and soldiers around the country in an effort to quell an uprising against the seizure of power 2 weeks ago. The junta also imposed an hours-long internet shutdown. Those developments come after protests turned violent on Sunday when security forces fired at demonstrators and arrested journalists. The situation has been tense in Myanmar after the military toppled the de facto leader Aung San Suu Kyi on the first day of February. Official data indicates that the world's third largest economy, Japan, contracted last year for the second sharpest margin on record since the 2009 global financial crisis. The information released by the Cabinet Office says that the country saw its GDP shrink by 4.8% in 2020 due to the coronavirus pandemic. The domestic consumption fell some 6%, while exports were reduced by more than 12% due to lockdowns. The data, however, suggests the contraction ended the year on a strong note thanks to a pickup in exports and a huge government stimulus. The virus is seen pushing the Japanese economy back into contraction, but officials say that a recovery could return once the authorities end the state of emergency that covers Tokyo and other major cities. Professor Seijiro Takeshita from School of Management and Information in Shizuoka University joined us earlier with his take on the state of Japanese economy and its path ahead amid the pandemic.
Considering the very conservative nature of the Japanese companies and Japanese public themselves, it's easily understandable that people tend to withdraw from investment or spending or private consumption when things get bad, especially this COVID-19. Regressing back with new forms, et cetera, people have been very much, I'd say, dampened on their sentiment when this happened. Now, there's also a very strange situation that's going on, what I would call a decoupling, not only in the economy, but also in the financial market as well. You're seeing some of the manufacturers like semiconductors, automobile doing extremely well, whereas areas of non-manufacturing like service is doing really bad. And as you just reported, although there's a lot of question mark in our economy, you can see the financial markets are doing spectacularly well, especially stock market. Has regained over its high. It's continues to basically record its post high after the bubble. So we're seeing a lot of decoupling that's taking place both in the economy and in the financial arena.
New Zealand's largest city, Auckland, goes under lockdown after two cases of the more transmissible British COVID variant are found there. Prime Minister Jacinda Ardern has ordered a three-day lockdown in Auckland. She says the detection of the first cases of the new COVID variant necessitates swift and robust action to nullify the possibility of its further transmission. Wearing masks on public transport and a ban on gatherings are also mandated for the remainder of the country. New Zealand has been widely praised for its handling of the pandemic. It has only registered 25 deaths and just 2,300 cases in a population of 5 million since the pandemic started a year ago. Pro-independence parties in Spain's Catalonia have won the largest number of seats in the regional parliament, expanding their majority. With over 90% of the ballots counted, three pro-independence parties secured a total of 74 seats in the 135-seat assembly. And that's up from 70 seats won in the last election in December 2017. The Socialist Party that leads Spain's central government, however, got 33 seats, which are more than any other single party. For the first time, the far-right Vox Party entered the Autonomous Regions Parliament, winning 11 seats. The turnout was low due to the pandemic. It was at 53%, and this despite voters with confirmed or suspected COVID symptoms being able to cast their ballots in a special time slot. Political analyst Laos Sazde says that Catalonia's pro-independence parties are deeply divided, and it's not certain if they could put in place a functioning grand coalition.
And even though the pro-independence parties got in a total of collectively 74 seats, but we also have to pay attention to the fact that they are, I believe, deeply divided. I mean, there is only one thing that would have in common, independence. But for instance, you have Esquerra Republicana Catalana, they are communists, and they got 33 seats. Then you have Junts per Catalunya, I believe. It's 32 seats. They are like, I would say, nationalists. They are not communists. They are not far left or left. It will be like nationalist, Republican, pro-independence Catalonians. And then you have, I believe, nine seats for the CUP Candidatura de Unidad Popular, Candidacy for Popular Unity, those are hardcore communists. I mean, I would say they are, if not Stalinists, they are very close to or pro-Castro, pro-Cuba, communist dictatorship kind of regime they would like to have. So in case, I mean, would it be possible to make a grand coalition among those? And even if they do, they wouldn't represent the entire, I mean, the rest, the 47% of Catalonians or residents of Catalonia that did not vote.
A U.S. former President Donald Trump has been found not guilty in his second impeachment trial. Has the post-Trump era finally started after so much acrimony and fighting? That's just one of the many unanswered questions in a rather traumatized and divided nation. Rami Mazzahari has more.
Ex-President Donald Trump has been acquitted in his second impeachment trial, finally closing the curtain on the nation's bitterly disputed election last November. Trump was accused of incitement to insurrection after a violent protest stormed Capitol Hill as Congress was certifying the Electoral College's selection of Joe Biden. Polls still show that around 40% of voters think that Biden's victory was illegitimate. Public opinion was almost evenly split regarding Trump's responsibility in the Capitol Hill protests and along party lines. The Senate vote's outcome was never in doubt, as a two-thirds supermajority was needed for conviction. The trial was surprisingly rushed to completion.
Trump's big sin, from the point of view of the American ruling class, is that he brought the pitchforks to the castle. And that's what the ruling class is, and the entire apparatus of status quo politics in the United States is punishing Donald Trump for, and wants to make sure never happens again.
Democrats now have to contend with an exonerated Trump who can run for the presidency in 2024. Conservatives may be permanently divided into two factions, and polls show that a third party started by Trump would be even more popular than the Republican Party. The final fate of the controversial Trump seemed to overshadow what sparked the violent protest in the first place, yet the question remains. How can massive and violent disputes over electoral integrity be prevented?
A, have an electoral system that people have confidence in and can have confidence in, which we don't have. But even more, hey, we're giving you medical care. You have medical care. Your rent is paid. You have a job. You have an income. You know, you don't have to worry about student debt. How many of those people are going to come to fight you over that?
Other questions remain, which are even more difficult to answer. Can a Trump-obsessed nation actually move on? Will Washington now focus on fixing the socioeconomic catastrophes caused by the coronavirus and lockdowns? How can this deeply divided nation heal? And when? And maybe, do they even want to? Given Trump's acquittal, many wonder if the impeachment trial ultimately did more harm than good. The Trump presidential era may be definitively over, finally, but the transition to get there was anything but peaceful. Ramin Mazahari, Chicago.
That's a wrap for this news bulletin. Goodbye.
This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
the limelight.
New evidence emerged in the impeachment trial about what former President Donald J. Trump did from roughly 1 to 6 p.m. the day of the Capitol attack. However, many questions still remain unanswered. The impeachment trial of former President Donald Trump largely focused on his actions leading up to the violent attack on the Capitol on Wednesday, 6th of January. But there was a crucial period that day of nearly 5 hours between the end of Mr. Trump's speech at the Ellipse, urging his supporters to march to the Capitol, and a final tweet telling his followers to remember the day forever. That remains critical to his state of mind. The article you're about to hear has been written by the New York Times journalists Maggie Haberman and Jonathan Martin. The piece is titled, After the Speech, What Trump Did as the Capitol Was Attacked. New evidence emerged in the impeachment trial about what former President Donald J. Trump did from roughly 1 to 6 p.m. the day of the Capitol attack. However, many questions still remain unanswered. The impeachment trial of former President Donald Trump largely focused on his actions leading up to the violent attack on the Capitol on Wednesday, 6th of January. But there was a crucial period that day of nearly 5 hours between the end of Mr. Trump's speech at the Ellipse, urging his supporters to march to the Capitol, and a final tweet telling his followers to remember the day forever. That remains critical to his state of mind. Evidence emerged during the trial about what Donald Trump was doing during those crucial hours, including new details about 2 phone calls with lawmakers that prosecutors said clearly alerted the president to the mayhem on Capitol Hill. Prosecutors said the new information was clear proof of Mr. Trump's intent to incite the mob and of his dereliction of duty, his failure to stop the violence even when he knew that the life of Vice President Mike Pence was in danger. Senator Mitch McConnell of Kentucky, the Republican leader who on Saturday voted to acquit Mr. Trump but offered a sweeping endorsement of the prosecutor's case, backing them up. Mitch McConnell said, "There is no question, none, that President Trump is practically and morally responsible for provoking the events of the day. No question about it." Still, many crucial questions remain unanswered about the president's actions and mood from roughly 1 to 6 p.m. on Wednesday, 6th of January. Here is what is known so far. Mr. Trump concluded his incendiary speech on the Ellipse at 1:11 p.m. He had repeatedly told the crowd that the election was stolen from him and urged his supporters to march to the Capitol in a last-ditch effort to stop President-elect Joseph R. Biden Jr.'s victory from being certified. Donald Trump said twice that he would go with them, and days before the march, he had told advisers that he wanted to join his supporters, but aides told him that people in the crowd were armed and that the Secret Service would not be able to protect him. 6 minutes later, Mr. Trump's motorcade began heading back to the White House. He arrived at the White House at 1:19 p.m. as the crowd was making its way up Pennsylvania Avenue and beginning to swarm around the Capitol. Television news footage showed the mob as it moved closer to the doors. At some point, Donald Trump went to the Oval Office and watched news coverage of the situation that was growing increasingly tense on Capitol Hill. At 1:34 p.m., Mayor Muriel Bowser of Washington made a formal request for assistance in a phone call with the Army Secretary Ryan D. McCarthy. At 1:49 p.m. on Wednesday, as the Capitol Police asked Pentagon officials for help from the National Guard, Mr. Trump tweeted a video of his incendiary rally speech. It was around this time that some of Mr. Trump's allies publicly called on him to do something. Chris Christie, the former governor of New Jersey, told ABC News that Mr. Trump needed to say something to stop the rioting on Capitol Hill. At 2:12 p.m. on Wednesday, 6th of January, the same moment that the mob breached the building itself, Vice President Mike Pence, who had defied the president by saying he planned to certify Mr. Biden's victory, was rushed off the Senate floor. Just a minute later, the Senate session was recessed. 2 minutes after that, at 2:15 p.m., groups of rioters began to chant, "Hang Mike Pence." Just 9 minutes later, at 2:24 p.m., Donald Trump tweeted a broadside at Mike Pence for moving ahead to certify Joe Biden's victory. Mike Pence didn't have the courage to do what should have been done to protect our country and our Constitution, giving states a chance to certify a corrected set of facts, not the fraudulent or inaccurate ones which they were asked to previously certify. USA demands the truth. At 2:26 p.m., after Mike Pence had been whisked away, a call was placed from the White House to Senator Mike Lee, Republican of Utah, according to call logs that the senator provided during the impeachment proceedings. The president had made the call, but he was actually looking for Senator Tommy Tuberville, Republican of Alabama. Senator Mike Lee gave the phone to Senator Tuberville, who has told reporters that he informed Donald Trump that Mike Pence had just been escorted out as the mob got closer to the Senate chamber. "I said, 'Mr. President, they just took the Vice President out. I've got to go,'" Mr. Tuberville recounted to the website Politico. This was a significant new piece of information. House prosecutors used it to argue that Donald Trump was clearly aware that his Vice President Mike Pence was in danger and that he had a callous disregard for Mr. Pence's safety. On Friday, Mr. Trump's defense team had insisted that Mr. Trump was not aware of any peril facing his Vice President Mike Pence. Back at the White House, advisors were trying to get Donald Trump to do something, but he rebuffed calls to intercede, including those from people wanting to see the National Guard deployed on Capitol Hill. The president, several advisers said, was expressing pleasure that the vote to certify Joe Biden's win had been delayed and that people were fighting for him. According to public reports, he watched television quite happily as the chaos unfolded. Mitch McConnell said on Saturday, he kept pressing his scheme to overturn the election, even after it was clear to any reasonable observer that Vice President Mike Pence was in serious danger, even as the mob carrying Trump banners was beating cops and breaching perimeters. The president sent a further tweet attacking his own vice president. Senator Lindsey Graham of South Carolina, a close Republican ally of Donald Trump, told the Washington Post that he called Ivanka Trump, Donald Trump's eldest daughter, to try to get her to reason with her father. Mark Meadows, the White House chief of staff, also called Ivanka Trump to see if she could talk to her father. A short time later, she arrived in the Oval Office, urging Donald Trump to issue a statement. The White House counsel, Pat Cipollone, hammered at Mr. Trump to understand that he had potential legal exposure for what was taking place on Capitol Hill. Finally, at 2:38 p.m., Donald Trump tweeted, "Please support our Capitol Police and law enforcement. They are truly on the side of our country. Stay peaceful." A short time later, at 3:13 p.m., Donald Trump added a note. I'm asking for everyone at the U.S. Capitol to remain peaceful. No violence. Remember, we are the party of law and order. Respect the law and our great men and women in blue. Thank you. Ivanka Trump quoted her father's tweet when she sent out her own, telling American patriots to follow the law. She quickly deleted it and replaced it when she faced blowback on Twitter for appearing to praise the rioters as patriots. Around 3:30 p.m., Representative Kevin McCarthy of California, the House Republican leader and another ally of Donald Trump, told CBS News' Nora O'Donnell that he had spoken that afternoon with Donald Trump as the Capitol was under siege. Representative Kevin McCarthy of California, the House Republican, said, I told him he needed to talk to the nation. I told him what was happening right then. The call became heated, according to a Republican congresswoman. Representative Jamie Herrera Butler of Washington State, who said that Mr. McCarthy told her that Mr. Trump had sided with the mob as the Capitol attack unfolded, suggesting he had made a choice not to stop the violence. In a statement on Friday night, 12th of February, that was admitted into evidence in the trial on Saturday, Ms. Herrera Butler recounted that Mr. McCarthy had a shouting match with Donald Trump during the phone call. Mr. McCarthy had told Donald Trump that his own office windows were being broken into. Well, Kevin, I guess these people are more upset about the election than you are, Donald Trump said, according to a report by CNN that the congresswoman confirmed. Who do you think you're talking to? Mr. McCarthy fired back at one point, CNN reported, including an expletive. Meanwhile, the violence continued. At 4:17 p.m., Donald Trump posted a video on Twitter of him speaking directly to the camera in the Rose Garden at the White House. I know your pain, Mr. Trump said. I know you're hurt. We had an election that was stolen from us. It was a landslide election, and everyone knows it, especially the other side. But you have to go home now. He added, we have to have peace. We have to have law and order. We have to respect our great people in law and order. We don't want anybody hurt. The violence continued, however, well before the Capitol Police announced at 8 p.m. on Wednesday, 6th of January, that the building had been secured. Donald Trump put out a final tweet at 6:01 p.m. These are the things and events that happen when a sacred landslide election victory is so unceremoniously and viciously stripped away from great patriots who have been badly and unfairly treated for so long. Go home with love and in peace. Remember this day forever.
The debate.
Hello and welcome to Debate. I'm Marzia Hashimi. Thanks so much for being with us. Well, it has been 10 years since the Bahraini people stood up to the regime in Manama to say enough is enough. After years of repression by the Al Khalifa royal family, Bahrainis called for elections to be held. A decade prior to that, the people of Bahrain had been promised political reforms, but not only did they not happen, the situation continued to deteriorate with more repression, discrimination, and arrest. What has happened in Bahrain 10 years later. Stay with us as we take a look at all of this on This Debate.
A popular uprising, better known as the Islamic Awakening, came to Bahrain a decade ago. On February the 14th, 2011, people of Bahrain staged a massive demonstration in the capital, Manama. It was the beginning of a movement that plunged the autocratic Al-Khalifa regime into an unprecedented crisis. In the early days of protests, Manama's Pearl Roundabout was the symbol of the uprising. Tens of thousands of people gathered here to peacefully call for reforms. Protesters demanded a parliament with a popular mandate and a new constitution. The Bahraini regime was, however, quick to show its intolerant face to dissidents. Regime forces attacked the demonstrators, who firmly stood their ground. The brutal crackdown left many people dead as the police, in many occasions, fired live rounds directly at protesters. The heavy-handed attack led to protests increasing in size and intensity, with angry demonstrators calling for the downfall of the ruling family. The regime became incapable of withstanding increasing popular outrage, so 1 month into the protests, Manama authorized troops from Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates to enter the kingdom and help silence the voices of dissent with a harsher crackdown. Thousands of people were detained, including elected members of Bahrain's parliament. Many were tortured and killed in detention. The clampdown was rarely covered in Western mainstream media, and the Al-Khalifa regime didn't even get a slap on the wrist from the West for what it did to its own people. Critics say that's largely because the kingdom is a close American ally which hosts the United States Navy Fifth Fleet. Bahrain's uprising was suppressed, but did not die. Since 2011, anti-regime protests have been staged frequently in villages and towns across the tiny Persian Gulf kingdom. Scores of people have lost their lives, and hundreds of others have been injured over the past decade. Authorities also targeted thousands of religious and political figures and activists, among them opposition leader Sheikh Ali Salman, who was handed a life sentence, human rights activist Nabil Rajab, that was imprisoned, and Shia leader Sheikh Isa Qasim, whose nationality was stripped. Prominent human rights organization Amnesty International says systematic injustice in Bahrain has intensified in the past 10 years. The regime managed to forcefully contain the uprising without addressing the people's demands. But what is certain is that the public discontent hasn't gone away and is instead pushed below the surface for now.
I'd like to welcome my first guest to the program, Reza Kazem from the Islamic Human Rights Commission out of London. Thanks so much for being with us. Reza, what would you say was the main catalyst that brought the people to the streets 10 years ago?
I think one of the things that has been happening in Bahrain is the issues have been decades old, the pressure that's been created by the Bahrainis has been going on for quite some time, and it's not something that is new. I think the impetus for 2011, what happened there, was the context of what was going on and what was interestingly called the Arab Spring. And all of that kind of stuff that was going on in other countries and so on, it was part of the catalyst for this to actually take place in a much bigger way, so it would be seen as something that was very much part and parcel of people actually demanding their rights, expecting their rights, and making sure that they will get their rights over this period of time. So it was very much part and parcel of that hope that suddenly came to be expressed and articulated across different countries in West Asia and North Africa. And people were hoping that things would actually start to happen, which would actually make things substantially different, and there would be a changing of the regime that was in place, and people would be afforded more rights, and their demands would be met in terms of their political expectations and what was actually going to be going on. So I think the context of what was going around in that region was certainly played a major part in that new look to that whole pressure that Bahraini was providing, Bahraini activists were providing.
Well, let's look at since that time. Do you think that the situation has improved at all, or has it deteriorated in Bahrain?
I think we can see that despite the fact that Saudi Arabia had been calling for many years that, look, other people are going to be invading it, and there's, you know, kind of a political manipulation and so on and so forth going on by Iran, what in fact actually transpired was that Saudi Arabia was the country that actually took up arms and invaded the country. And instead of looking to support the people who were demanding their rights, it became, with the UAE, part and parcel of the oppressive structure. And so in that sense, what was actually made very, very clear to the Bahrainis was that this was not something that was going to be allowed to happen here, and any kind of expression would be subject to severe suppression, oppression, and kind of a way of making sure that those voices will not be heard, and so on. So I think that was very much, that's one of the elements of what actually happened over that period of time. And I think there were a number of systematic measures that were that took place. In, you know, one of in your initial introduction, you talked about the stripping away of Bahraini citizenship from Bahrainis who were campaigning and so on, to actually delegitimize, in an attempt to try and delegitimize what was actually going on in terms of the voices of the people being heard by prominent, you know, being made, and the voices being brought to prominence by, and the demands being brought to prominence by the people who were articulating those voices as being religious leaders and activists and so on and so forth. So a lot of measures were actually taking place, including also how the police demography actually changed over that period of time as well, in terms of how that would actually go on.
Well, Reza, I want to look at, you talked about the police aspect to it, but what we do know, as was said in the introduction, is that troops were sent in from Saudi Arabia and from the UAE, and they participated in a brutal crackdown on the people of Bahrain. When we look at Saudi Arabia and UAE, of course, the very strong allies of the United States, and we know that the Navy, U.S. Navy's Fifth Fleet, is in Bahrain. How much of what is happening in Bahrain do you feel that these Western countries are responsible for it? Do they have a responsibility in remaining, they remain silent, basically, during this crackdown?
I think they haven't remained silent. They've actually been the puppet masters, if you like. I mean, we need to keep Saudi Arabia and UAE in context. Their kind of significance is in terms of what the Western governments, and in particular the UK and the US, what they want to actually happen. Historically, Bahrain has been a place where ex-British police officers and ex-British officials actually go, so-called ex-British officials actually go, to try and make sure that the country is able to systematically crack down on any dissident voices, that it is able to actually control the population and manage the population so that the hegemony of the kingdom actually remains. And so Britain has historically played that part over a number of years. It continues to do so. So while it is in the background, it is still there and very much part and parcel of it. You can still see ex-British police officers from Scotland Yard and so on being involved in some of the policy making to actually crack down on these voices. So very much in terms of manipulating what's going on, in terms of managing what's going on, Britain is playing a part. And the obvious part that you mentioned of the United States is very much there. I think we also need to recognize that this kind of idea that what was going on in terms of the oppression is a Trump thing it's not a Trump thing. It's something that is deeply embedded in the fabric of the U.S. foreign policy.
Okay, stay with me, Reza. Stay with me. Let me. Our next guest has joined us, Jonathan Fryer, author and broadcaster out of London by telephone. Unfortunately, we had some problems establishing a video connection. Thanks so much for being with us, Jonathan. Well, we're just talking about the responsibility of what is happening in Bahrain, the repression that has taken place, how much of it will fall on the shoulders of countries such as the UK and the US. And Reza in London was talking about the British involvement and also getting to the American involvement. I want you to pick up from there and let's talk about that and why the so-called international community has basically said nothing while the repression has just continued to get worse in Bahrain.
Well, certainly the British have had responsibility for a long time in giving support to the police and security forces within Bahrain, and that is a situation that is ongoing. We have to remember that Bahrain was a British protectorate, although not a colony, during the first half of the 20th century, and that relationship has continued. Certainly the British standpoint, or British government standpoint, I should say, is very much that Britain should be supporting the king, who is, of course, Sunni, in a country that is overwhelmingly Shia, and that therefore there should be stability, and the British are absolutely committed to supporting that.
Jonathan, what does the UK want out of Bahrain, the UK and the US? Why would they want to see such instability? Because obviously the crackdown continues. There's an iron fist as far as how the regime deals with its people right now.
Well, the idea that the British have is that stability is the most important thing, and if one Gulf monarchy fell, and others could fall as well. Of course, Bahrain is unique in that it does have a Shia majority population and also had advanced quite far along the in the direction of a democratic parliamentary rule, which was really what a lot of people 10 years ago were demonstrating for. And I think that we will see this continues as long as the Conservative government is in power, that there will be support for the ruling family of Bahrain and other Gulf monarchies, however frustrating that may be for Iran and indeed for many of the Shia in Bahrain itself.
Reza, now the leading religious scholar who was in Bahrain, Sheikh Isa Qasim, first of all, he stressed the importance of unity between Shia and Sunnis, and he said that the uprising must continue until the Bahraini people in general attain freedom. Your take on that?
I think one of the things that needs to be recognized is right at the beginning, when all of this was actually kicking off and the demands that have been made, while the majority of people, the activists and so on, that were in the front line were from the Shia community, there were also people who were there from the Sunni community that were actually also there in terms of protesting and wanting those reforms to actually take place. So I think we need to be careful about painting this into a Shia-Sunni kind of Sunni monarchy, Shia population kind of narrative, because that is not going to be accurate in terms of recognizing where people were actually at. We've got people from the Sunni background who were locked up by the Sunni monarchy. So I think talking about it in those terms does not actually help, because what it does is try to play to the gallery of sectarianism that is and the fans of sectarianism, the flames of sectarianism that are actually being pushed by the United States, by Britain, and by some of the Western governments. And to try and make sure that this idea of divide and rule, which the British have actually employed very successfully over centuries to make sure that they ravage the countries that they are the colonial masters of, I think that is very much part and parcel of that. So I think we need to move away from this because it is very much about an oppressive system that is in place. It's not about whether other countries recognize and feel that it's that they're going to be unhappy about it. The Bahraini people are the ones that are the most important people in this respect, because it's about their government, it's about their where they're located, and their rights that are being suppressed by an oppressive regime that is supported by Saudi Arabia, by the UAE, by the UK, and by the US governments. And all of these things are actually happening. So I think we need to make sure that that characterization of this issue is done in a way that reflects the reality of the situation.
Jonathan, do you think that the situation right now, that there can be changes made and improve the situation? Or do you think at this point in time, what the Bahraini people are demanding is a total end to this regime? Can reform still take place?
You're right to say there's no chance at all of it happening, but I don't think it will happen very soon, unfortunately. Reza is absolutely correct in saying that, of course, several of the Sunni majority were active in the demonstrations 10 years ago, and they too wanted to see Bahrain open up. It's very tragic, because Bahrain was, in many ways, the most open and liberal society in the Gulf until 2011. And really, it's under Saudi pressure particularly, slammed down against the reform movement. And that's been put back several years. I wouldn't say it will never reform. I think that one day, all of the Gulf monarchies have got to reform. And we've seen how some of them have started to do it. Even Saudi Arabia itself has started to open up in some ways compared to what it was even 5 years ago.
Reza, in your perspective, what is it going to take for the Bahraini people to attain the victory that they want?
I think this attempt at trying to negotiate from a position of weakness and trying to get your rights to be handed over to you on a platter are not going to be something that is going to happen. I don't think when you've got someone who is being oppressive, that the oppressor is certainly going to give way without feeling the need to give something away, without feeling the need to give the rights to people. This whole issue of human rights from the UK and the US angle is a complete joke. And people who are relying on the UK and the US need to look at everything that has been going on historically over centuries in that region, and need to look at the fate of other people in terms of how autonomy and getting control of your own government to stopping the oppression is not going to be something that is handed over to you by the oppressor. I think there is a lot more in terms of resistance that needs to be looked at and scrutinized about how to move forward within that framework, because unless they feel that there is going to be something that is going to be so problematic for them that they will not, it will be worth their while to come and give serious consideration to how the rights of people can actually be given. Unless that is done, nothing much is going to happen. And even within that, they need to be really careful that this is not a ruse to actually just get them onto around the negotiating table to talk and talk and talk and then achieve nothing. You need to make sure that you've got something else up your sleeve, as it were, in terms of resistance to this oppressive regime. Otherwise, you're going to get the same old, and we'll be back here 10 years' time, looking at the anniversary, 20-year anniversary, with nothing further having actually been achieved.
All right. And on that note, I thank both of you for being with us on this debate. Jonathan Fryer, author and broadcaster out of London, also out of London, Reza Kazem from the Islamic Human Rights Commission. And as always, we appreciate you being with us on this debate. I'm Marzia Hashimi, signing out for myself and all the group right here in Tehran.
This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim, in the name of Allah, the most compassionate, the most merciful, my dear brothers and sisters in Islam. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Thank you all very much for joining us in today's edition of the program, Heaven in Grief. I'm Fatima Shamili. We have come together on the occasion of the martyrdom of Imam Hadi alayhi salam, our 10th Imam. And inshallah, we hope that we will have some blessed moments to talk about the life of this great Imam. With me in the studio today is Dr. Radia Batul Najafi. Assalamu alaikum, doctor. Thank you very much for being here.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah.
Thank you very much for being here in the studio with us, for giving us some of your time.
No, I'm so blessed. You know, whenever we have any show regarding A'imma alayhi salam, I feel that, you know, this is a great opportunity that Imam has given to us.
Okay, so I think that, you know, when you look at the life of Imam Hadi alayhi salam in a glance, you will see that he tried very much to highlight the role of imamat throughout his life. So he was the grandfather of our awaited Imam, Imam Mahdi, ajallallahu ta'ala farajahu sharif. And he, in his role, in his share, tried very hard. Although he was kept in prison and he was kept under strict control by Mutawakkil, the caliph of that time, however, he chose deputies or nawab to somehow convey his message to the people, to the followers of the Ahlul Bayt. So let's begin with that what were the measures that Imam Hadi alayhi salam took to highlight the role of the awaited Imam, and to familiarize people with the concept that, okay, soon there will be an Imam who is there, but not all of you can see, right?
Exactly. As a true awaiter, inshallah, in this living in this major cultation, I think we have to reflect a lot and connect a lot to Imam Hadi alayhi salam. And unfortunately, usually people, they don't know in detail about the seerah and character and the sacrifices of Imam alayhi salam.
Mm-hmm.
Imam Hadi alayhi salam is the first Imam who has been moved and migrated from city of Medina by force towards Baghdad and Samarra. And more than 20 years in that critical situation, Imam Hadi alayhi salam, where, you know, he could not talk to address his lovers, his followers, his companions directly. So that moment, because he was the first one, yeah, so he is establishing beautiful, the techniques of A'imma alayhi salam are so amazing.
He was so young, right?
Exactly. He was only 7 or 8 when he became an imam, yeah? And then he was in the city of Medina for approximately 13 years. And
so after 20 years.
Yeah, in his 20s, in very young age, he is in Samarra. And Samarra, we know that it is worse than a prison, because Mutawakkil was the worst, you know, caliph of Abbasid. And Imam Ali alayhi salam has mentioned about him in Nahj al-Balagha. You know, like Imam Ali would see that one of his son would meet Mutawakkil, and how much